Today we're pulling back the curtain on something huge, something vital, but often, well, invisible. We're talking about the freight rail system. Think about this unseen network that quietly powers the whole North American economy. It's delivering everything, you know, from the grain in your cereal to the packages arriving at your doorstep. It's foundational, maybe even overlooked sometimes, but its health really impacts everything. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take complex topics, stacks of info, and boil them down to the core insights just for you. Today, we are diving deep into the Canadian National Railway Company, or CNI. We're using an in-depth investment analysis framework here. Our mission, to give you a real shortcut to being truly well-informed about this foundational company. We'll uncover some maybe surprising facts, look at the dynamics shaping this world. By the end of this, you won't just know what CNI does, but really grasp why it matters so much to the North American logistics backbone and ultimately to you.
That's absolutely right. And over, say, the next 20 to 30 minutes, we're going to explore CNI's unique strategic position. We'll look at the competitive landscape it operates in, which is complex and changing. We'll cover its financial performance and definitely the big opportunities and, yes, the risks it faces. We'll start by, you know, setting the rails, metaphorically speaking, helping you understand the basic structure of this whole North American freight rail industry and CNI's really crucial place within it. It's a story of, well, immense scale, quiet power, and maybe some surprising vulnerability too.
Okay, sounds good. Let's start with a term maybe people have heard but haven't really dug into. Class I railroad. What exactly does that mean? Why is that designation so important when we talk about CNI?
Right. A Class I railroad. It's not just a label for a big company. It's very specific. It's a designation for freight railroads that have annual operating revenues over a certain threshold, a pretty substantial one. For 2023, I think it was over US $1.05 billion. And these aren't just large corporations. They are truly massive continent-spanning enterprises. There are only six of them that really dominate the North American system. They are, and this is an exaggeration, the absolute backbone of how freight moves on this continent. You've got Canadian National, CNI, who we're focused on. Then it's Canadian rival, Canadian Pacific, Kansas City, CPKC. And in the U.S., you have Union Pacific, BNSF Railway, that's the one owned by Berkshire Hathaway, CSX Transportation, and Norfolk Southern, the Big Six.
The Big Six. And these six, they aren't just like major players. They essentially are the system. Is that right?
That's a great way to put it, precisely. They form this integrated network. It's nearly 140,000 miles of track across North America. And just to give you a sense of their scale, these six companies alone, they account for about 67% of the entire industry's track mileage.
67%? Wow.
Yeah. And a staggering 90% of its employees. Mm. And get this, 93% of its freight revenue.
93%.
It's incredible dominance. Their scale is just immense. And the impact, well, it's felt continent-wide. Just imagine, maybe try to picture if just one of these six Class I railroads went offline for a week.
Oh, man.
We wouldn't just be talking about delayed Amazon packages. I mean, whole industries could literally grind to a halt. Major cities might face shortages of everything from, you know, fresh food to fuel. They are truly the invisible, indispensable backbone keeping our modern lives running.
That really puts their dominance into sharp focus.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are they actually moving across this huge network? Is it just, you know, the classic image of trains full of coal, or is it more varied?
Oh, much more varied. Far from it. I mean, yes, bulk commodities, things like coal, grain, chemicals are absolutely a significant part of the business, you know, the staples of industry. But these Class I railroads, they transport an incredibly diverse range of freight. Think intermodal containers, those big metal boxes you see stacked on ships, then put on trains, then on trucks.
Right, the standardized one.
Exactly. They move finished vehicles, cars rolling right off the assembly line, the trucks that deliver your goods, even specialized industrial equipment or these huge oversized components that simply can't move any other way. I mean, theoretically, you could probably ship a full-sized whale by train if you really had to, though I wouldn't recommend it for obvious reasons.
Okay, maybe let's stick to cars and grain.
Yeah.
So for us, the listeners, how does this sort of invisible network really connect to our day-to-day lives? Mm. I mean, beyond just knowing they're big companies,
right,
why should we genuinely care about how CNI operates?
Oh, it's direct. It's profound, really. Think about it this way. The grain in your breakfast cereal this morning, the lumber that maybe built parts of your house, even the components that went into assembling your smartphone, chances are a lot of that stuff traveled on one of these railroads at some point. They really are like the circulatory system of our modern economy, quietly making sure goods move efficiently, cost-effectively. Without them, our modern supply chain would just seize up. It would mean higher prices, scarcity for almost everything you consume. They are the silent engines of commerce, truly.
Okay, we've established how essential they are. But that dominance makes me wonder, how does anyone even get into this business? Is it effectively an oligopoly? Are new players just locked out?
You've absolutely nailed a critical point there. This industry is practically a textbook example of an oligopoly. It's characterized by extremely high barriers to entry, just incredibly high. And here's the fundamental difference, the thing that sets them apart. Unlike trucking companies using public highways or barge lines on public waterways, these Class I railroads, they privately own, build, and maintain their own vast infrastructure.
So wait, they don't just run trains on the tracks, they actually own the tracks, the land under them, the bridges, the signals, the whole physical network.
Exactly that, the whole thing. And the financial commitment to keep that running, it's just staggering. Freight railroads collectively, privately, invest over $23 billion, billion with a B, annually.
$23 billion?
Yeah.
Every year?
Every single year. And that's mostly just to maintain their existing networks. We're not even talking about massive expansion projects here, just keeping the current system safe, operational, replacing worn-out track and bridges.
Just the maintenance bill is $23 billion.
Yeah. That figure alone should make you pause, right? It's not just the money, it's the sheer scale, the historical commitment needed to build and maintain something like that. That forms essentially an impenetrable fortress around the existing players.
$23 billion. That makes the idea of some new startup Class I competitor seem virtually impossible, doesn't it?
Yeah. It absolutely does. The sheer prohibitive cost to even think about replicating an existing network makes the emergence of a new Class I competitor basically impossible. And that just cements the industry's oligopolistic structure. What's really fascinating here, I think, is how this fundamental structure creates such a powerful economic moat around these companies. It makes them incredibly stable investments historically, but it also means it's incredibly challenging for new players to even dream of entering.
Right.
And this structure also fosters what the industry often calls disciplined competition.
Disciplined competition. What does that mean in practice?
Well, while they definitely compete for business, especially where their networks overlap, those immense fixed costs owning all that track and the whole network-based nature of the operation, it incentivizes rational pricing. They need to ensure they get adequate returns on those massive capital bases just to keep investing that $23 billion a year.
Okay, so it keeps prices from collapsing, maybe.
Exactly. It supports strong pricing power, particularly for what are called captive shippers.
Captive shippers.
Yeah, imagine a large factory or a mine that only has a rail spur connecting to one railroad, say, CNI. They don't really have a practical alternative for moving bulk goods.
So CNI can charge them more?
They certainly have more leverage in that negotiation. That's the reality of the structure.
But isn't that just sort of a polite way of saying they have a near monopoly in some situations and can basically set prices? Especially for those captive guys, how does that actually benefit the wider economy? Or does it?
That's an excellent question, and frankly, it's a point of constant debate and tension. While competition is clearly limited in those captive situations, the argument for allowing this oligopoly to exist, at least from a regulatory standpoint, it rests on the idea that these companies need to earn sufficient returns to keep pouring those billions back into the infrastructure.
Right, that $23 billion maintenance bill again.
Exactly. If they couldn't earn those returns, the argument goes, the network would degrade, service would suffer, and that would impact everyone, the entire economy. But yes, for say a big auto manufacturer whose plant only has rail access from CNI, that lack of direct rail competition can definitely mean higher shipping costs for their steel or parts.
And those costs get passed on?
Ultimately, yes. Those higher costs inevitably trickle down. They could add a sort of hidden railroad premium to the price of your new car, or even indirectly to your groceries. It's a really delicate balance that the regulators are supposed to manage.
You mentioned regulation earlier, saying it's a dual regulatory framework.
Mm-hmm.
Is that regulation generally a help or a hindrance for giants like CNI? It feels like it could cut both ways.
It's absolutely a double-edged sword, no question. The industry operates under this really stringent and complex set of regulations covering both economic activity and safety. In the U.S., you've got Surface Transportation Board, the STB, handling economic oversight, and then the Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA, focuses on safety. Up in Canada, the counterparts are the Canadian Transportation Agency, or CTA, for economics, and Transport Canada for safety. These bodies are powerful, and their influence is pervasive.
Okay, so focusing on the economic side, what does the STB actually do? Do they step in and set freight rates directly, or is it more indirect?
Their mandate, which largely comes from the Staggers-Rail Act of 1980, a landmark piece of legislation, is primarily to let market demand set the rates where competition exists. However, and this is crucial, they retain the authority to intervene in cases of market dominance.
Market dominance.
Yeah.
That sounds like those captive shipper situations again.
Precisely. Where competition is deemed ineffective, the STB can step in and review the reasonableness of a rate. But their power goes way beyond just rates. They oversee disputes between railroads and shippers. They approve or significantly reject mergers.
Ah, right. Mergers are a big deal in this industry.
Huge. They also regulate line acquisitions, and even when a railroad wants to abandon a line, they are really the ultimate arbiters of how the rail map evolves, how conflicts get settled. They have a massive impact on the strategic choices these companies can make.
And how does this regulation then reinforce those high barriers to entry we talked about? Does it make it harder for competition to emerge?
It's a massive factor, and maybe one that people outside the industry don't fully appreciate. Think about the sheer amount of, well, bureaucracy involved in getting anything major approved. The approval processes for mergers or even building significant new lines are incredibly rigorous and often take years. Years.
Okay.
This makes it exceedingly difficult to fundamentally alter the competitive map. It essentially protects the stability, some would say the inertia, of the existing oligopoly. It makes it incredibly hard for a new player to realistically challenge the status quo, or even for the existing players to dramatically reshape the market through big acquisitions.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. A perfect recent example was the whole bidding war for Kansas City Southern Railway a few years back. Both CNI and CP wanted to buy it. The STB reviewed both bids very carefully. Ultimately, they blocked CNI's bid, citing concerns about potentially reduced competition in certain corridors.
So they stopped CNI from getting bigger in that instance.
Exactly. But they did eventually approve the merger between Canadian Pacific and KCS, creating the CPKC we mentioned earlier. So for CNI, this regulatory environment means its competitive position is relatively safe from, you know, disruptive new entrants or huge landscape-altering mergers initiated by others against them.
But the flip side?
The flip side is that CNI's own ability to pursue those kinds of transformative acquisitions is just as constrained by that same regulatory oversight. It's definitely a trade-off for them. Stability versus strategic flexibility.
That's a really crucial point. Protection, but also restriction. So for us, the listeners, how do these regulatory decisions, which often happen kind of behind closed doors, actually affect us day to day?
Well, they directly influence the efficiency and ultimately the cost of goods moving through the rail system. If regulatory changes suddenly increase operating costs for railroads, maybe near safety mandates or environmental rules, those costs are likely to eventually get passed down the supply chain.
Meaning higher prices for us?
Potentially, yes. Conversely, if regulators streamline processes or approve investments that make certain corridors more efficient, that could lead to faster, more reliable, maybe even slightly lower cost movement of goods. So whether it's the sticker price on a new car or how reliably your online order arrives, these often unseen regulatory decisions play a pretty significant and tangible role in the flow of our economy and the cost of the things we buy.
Okay, that sets the industry stage really well.
Yeah.
Let's zoom in now specifically on CNI. What are its unique strengths and how is the competitive landscape around it really shifting? You mentioned CNI's network earlier, calling it tri-coastal. What exactly makes that network so special, such a core advantage?
Right. CNI's most significant and probably its most durable competitive advantage is absolutely that unique tri-coastal rail network. It's really a marvel of logistical engineering built up over decades. CNI operates about 20,000 route miles of track, and it is the only railroad in North America that connects the Atlantic coast, the Pacific coast, and the U.S. Gulf coast.
The only one. Nobody else does that.
Nobody else. That's not just a neat geographical fact. It's a really powerful economic moat.
So they truly span the continent in a way their competitors can't match. Can you trace that out for us?
Yeah, you can visualize it. It stretches from critical Atlantic ports like Halifax and Nova Scotia and Montreal and Quebec, all the way across the continent to the key Pacific gateways, Vancouver, and importantly, Prince Rupert in British Columbia. And then crucially, the network extends south, deep into the industrial heartland of the U.S. Midwest, reaching all the way down to the bustling port of New Orleans and the Gulf of Mexico. This huge geographic footprint gives shippers just unparalleled supply chain efficiency and optionality, more choices.
And I've heard people talk about Prince Rupert specifically. Mm. What makes that port such a potential game changer, especially for goods coming from Asia?
That's a great point. The port of Prince Rupert is a really critical piece of that Pacific advantage. Geographically, it offers a significant time advantage. It's actually up to 2 days closer by sea to major Asian ports compared to other big West Coast ports like, say, Los Angeles or Long Beach.
2 days faster. That sounds like a big deal in logistics.
It's huge. For containerized goods coming from Asia, think electronics, clothes, all sorts of consumer goods, shaving 2 days off the ocean transit time can be a massive competitive edge. It reduces transit times overall, cuts down on inventory holding costs for shippers. It's a real draw.
Okay, and you mentioned single line haul earlier. Why is that specific term so important? Is it just about convenience?
Oh, it's much, much more than just convenience. It's about efficiency and reliability. Moving goods on a single line haul means the shipment stays on CNI's network from origin, say the port, to the inland destination like Chicago or Memphis. This eliminates the need to interchange the freight, hand it off to a different railroad mid-journey.
And switching railroads causes problems.
It absolutely can. Every time freight has to switch carriers, there's a potential for delay, there's added complexity in tracking, there's a risk of damage during the transfer, and there are additional administrative costs and fees.
Right. More handoffs, more chances for things to go wrong.
Exactly. So CNI's ability to offer that seamless single-line service, especially for valuable or time-sensitive intermodal freight, it creates what we call a sticky customer relationship.
Sticky? Meaning customers don't want to leave?
Pretty much. It's just a superior value proposition, in many cases faster, simpler, often more reliable. And that has historically been a formidable barrier to competition for CNI. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this unique network position has long been CNI's crown jewel, providing a seamless flow for global trade. But, and this is key, it's now facing some new challenges that could really test its strength going forward.
Okay, let's unpack those challenges. Starting with operational efficiency. CNI was famous for being the pioneer here, right? They essentially invented the playbook for what's called Precision Scheduled Railroading, or PSR.
That's absolutely right. CNI was indeed the pioneer of PSR. And this wasn't just some minor operational tweak. It was truly a revolutionary philosophy that completely transformed the North American rail industry over the last couple of decades. Before PSR, railroads often operated more like gathering systems. Cars would wait in yards until a full train could be built. PSR flipped that. It focused intensely on maximizing asset utilization, squeezing the most out of every locomotive, every railcar, every employee hour. By running a highly disciplined, scheduled network, trains run on schedule, like passenger trains, whether they're full or not, cars don't sit idle.
And that gave them a real edge for a long time.
For years, yes. CNI's execution of PSR was exceptional, and it gave them a distinct cost advantage. They consistently produced the lowest operating ratio among their peers.
Operating ratio, that's expenses as a percentage of revenue, right?
Yeah.
Lower is better.
Exactly. Lower OR means higher efficiency, higher profitability. And CNI was the undisputed leader, the gold standard for years.
But I'm hearing that maybe that edge isn't quite as sharp as it used to be. What's happened? Did everyone else just copy their playbook?
That's largely it. The operational advantage CNI once held, it's significantly narrowed. Why? Because their competitors saw the success and they successfully and often aggressively implemented their own versions of PSR. You look at the numbers now. CNI's adjusted operating ratio for 2024 was 62.9%. Still a good number, objectively.
Right.
But Union Pacific actually beat that, coming in at 59.9%. And CPKC, CNI's main rival now, reported a core adjusted OR of 60.7% in Q2 2025.
So CNI is no longer leading the pack on that key metric.
Right. And it's not just about a few percentage points here or there. It signals a pretty fundamental shift where CNI's long-held operational leadership is being seriously challenged at its core.
So their unique playbook, the one they invented, has basically become the industry standard playbook now.
Mm.
Are there other metrics, other KPIs that really illustrate this convergence, show that everyone's kind of operating at a similar level now?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. You see it across other key performance indicators too. Take car velocity, that's how many miles a freight car travels per day on average. In 2024, CNI's was 209 miles per day.
Really?
Union Pacific, 208 miles per day. Very comparable. Or look at train speed. CNI's average through network train speed was about 18.9 miles per hour in 2024. CSX's system average was 18.7 miles per hour. Again, very similar.
Hmm. So the numbers are really clustering together now.
They are. These figures really indicate that the operational excellence CNI pioneered, well, it's now essentially the baseline expectation for the entire industry. It's table stakes. The competitive edge today isn't so much about having a radically different operating model anymore. It's about relentlessly perfecting the execution of that model.
Okay, let's unpack this. CNI invented the playbook for efficiency, but now it seems everyone else is running the same plays just as well. So what does this all mean for their competitive edge moving forward? Is it just a game of inches now?
It really is. It means PSR, in itself, is no longer a unique differentiator for CNI. It's the industry standard, the cost of entry, to be considered a top-tier railroad. Now, CNI absolutely still has a strong reputation for being a well-run railroad, but its future outperformance, its ability to command maybe a premium valuation, it's going to depend less on having a fundamentally different operating model and much more on consistent, superior execution day in, day out. And critically, the ability to recover faster and more effectively than competitors from the inevitable disruptions, weather, derailments, you name it, that hit any rail network.
So it's about execution, execution, execution.
Precisely. It's about doing the standard things better than anyone else every single day and building that reputation for reliability that keeps shippers loyal even when the core operating philosophy looks similar across the board.
And speaking of competition getting tougher, there was that massive fundamental shift you mentioned earlier, the CPKC merger. How has that truly altered the landscape for CNI, especially given CNI's unique tri-coastal advantage?
Yeah, this wasn't just another deal. It was a monumental shift. It fundamentally altered the competitive dynamics in North American rail. In April 2023, the merger of Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern was finalized, forming CPKC. And the big deal here, this created the first and only single-line railway connecting Canada, the U.S., and Mexico.
Ah. So it created a direct competitor on that north-south axis.
Exactly. A seamless network, also around 20,000 miles, directly challenging CNI's previously unique three-coast network advantage. For years, CNI was the only game in town if you wanted a single railroad to take your goods seamlessly between, say, Western Canada and the U.S. Gulf Coast or the Midwest.
But now CPKC offers that too.
Now CPKC offers a viable alternative single-line route for freight moving along that vital U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement USMCA trade corridor. And while CNI's network arguably has greater density and reach within the core U.S. Midwest, CPKC's combined route often provides a more direct connection from key manufacturing hubs and ports in Mexico straight up to markets in the U.S. Midwest and into Canada.
That sounds particularly relevant with all the talk about nearshoring, bringing manufacturing back closer from Asia to Mexico.
It's hugely relevant. That trend plays directly into CPKC's new strength.
So this must be intensifying competition quite a bit, especially for that lucrative cross-border freight.
It absolutely will, and likely already is. This development is expected to really heat up both service competition and pricing competition, particularly for valuable traffic like finished automobiles moving north from Mexico or intermodal containers moving both ways. Freight that, for a single-line service, used to be almost exclusively CNI's domain in certain lanes.
So CNI has to fight harder now to keep that business.
They definitely have to aggressively defend their market share on those critical north-south routes. For you, the listener, the implication is this new rival, CPKC, means more options for shippers. That could potentially lead to better service levels across the board, maybe even downward pressure on shipping costs for goods moving within North America.
Good for shippers, maybe tougher for CNI.
That's the dynamic. It forces CNI to be even sharper, even more competitive. It raises the bar.
Here's where it gets really interesting. It's not just rail against rail, is it? It's this multimodal chess match. Rail versus truck, even versus pipeline. What goes into a shipper's calculation when they're deciding how to move their goods?
Right. It's rarely a simple decision. The choice of transportation mode for any given shipper is actually a pretty complex calculation. It hinges on a whole bunch of factors. You've got the overall cost, obviously, the required speed, how fast does it need to get there? Flexibility, can the mode handle pickups and deliveries easily? And of course, the specific type of commodity being moved. Is it bulk? Is it fragile? Is it perishable? Each mode, rail, truck, pipeline, even barge or air, has its unique sweet spot, its advantages and disadvantages. And companies often use a blend.
Okay, so where does rail truly dominate? What's its sort of killer application?
Rail's primary strength, its killer app, lies in its sheer cost-effectiveness and fuel efficiency for moving heavy, dense freight over very long distances. We're talking bulk commodities, mostly coal, grain, chemicals, aggregates, lumber, things where cost per ton mile is paramount. According to FRA data, rail is still the dominant mode in the U.S. by volume, carrying roughly 39.5% of all freight measured by ton miles.
Almost 40%. That's huge.
It is. And here's a compelling statistic. A single modern freight train can carry the load of several hundred trucks. Hundreds. Yeah. And moving freight by rail compared to truck typically reduces greenhouse gas emissions by up to 75%. So there's a significant environmental benefit too.
And the cost difference is dramatic.
For those bulk commodities, yes, it can be very dramatic. One analysis I saw compared sample direct costs. Rail came in around $70 per net ton.
Okay.
The equivalent move by over-the-road truck, almost $215 per net ton.
Whoa, more than three times the cost.
A massive difference for those types of goods. That's rail's core strength.
Okay. But obviously, trucks have clear advantages, too. You can't exactly back a freight train up to a loading dock at a supermarket, right?
Absolutely not. Trucking offers superior flexibility and speed, especially for shorter distances, say under 500 miles, and for time-sensitive shipments. Trucks are absolutely essential for true door-to-door service and that critical last-mile delivery that rail, on its own, simply cannot provide. They really dominate the market for higher-value merchandise, consumer goods, anything requiring that final delivery touchpoint. Their agility is key.
So where do rail and truck really slug it out? Is there a specific distance or type of freight where the competition is fiercest?
Yeah, the main competitive battleground often lies in that medium haul range. Let's call it roughly 500 to 750 miles, maybe a bit more. In that zone, shippers are constantly weighing the trade-off. Rail's lower cost and lower emissions versus trucking's faster transit time and greater service flexibility.
Okay.
And this is precisely why CNI's strategic focus on growing its intermodal business is so critical.
Intermodal. Yeah. Using those containers again.
Exactly. By moving those standardized containers that can easily transfer between ship, train, and truck, they're trying to offer the best of both worlds. Combine rail's long-haul efficiency for the middle part of the journey with trucking's flexibility for the first and last miles. It's a direct attempt to win market share from trucks in that contested medium haul space. Make rail feel more truck-like.
Got it. And what about pipelines? They seem like the ultimate low-cost option for things like oil or gas. How do they fit into this modal battle?
Pipelines are indeed the most cost-effective and generally the safest mode for transporting large volumes of liquids and gases, like crude oil and natural gas, no question. Shipping crude by pipeline might cost, say, $5 per barrel. By rail, it could be $10 to $15 per barrel.
So why use rail for crude at all then?
Flexibility. Pipelines are fixed assets. They go from point A to point B, and that's it. They can't easily change routes or destinations if market prices shift or a different refinery needs supply. Building new pipelines also involves incredibly long lead times, huge upfront costs, and significant regulatory and environmental hurdles.
Right. Getting approvals can take forever.
Exactly. So this inflexibility, combined with those hurdles, creates a really significant niche market for crude by rail. Rail offers shippers much shorter-term contracts, the ability to quickly redirect oil to different markets or refineries based on price differentials, and access to refineries that simply aren't connected to the major pipeline networks.
So rail provides the flexible alternative when pipelines aren't an option or aren't responsive enough.
Precisely. It offers optionality. So yeah, it's not just rail versus rail. It's this constant, complex, multimodal chess match where each mode plays to its strengths, depending on the commodity, the distance, the required speed, and even, you know, global events impacting logistics flows.
Okay, let's shift gears and dive into CNI's financial health now. When we look at their revenue streams, how diversified are they really? And what did the picture look like in 2024?
Right, looking at the financials, for the full year 2024, CNI reported total revenues of $17.05 billion, Canadian dollars, that is. And what's really crucial to understand about CNI's revenue base is its remarkable diversification. It's a key strength. Their revenue is spread across seven distinct commodity groups, things like intermodal, grain, petroleum and chemicals, forest products, metals and minerals, automotive, and coal. This diversification acts as a really vital buffer, a sort of natural hedge against a downturn in any single sector or industry.
So if, say, the auto industry has a bad year, strength in grain shipments might help balance things out.
Exactly. If one industry is struggling, maybe another one, like energy or agriculture, is having a boom year, that helps stabilize their overall top-line revenue. It reduces volatility compared to a less diversified company.
Okay, sounds like a major strength. But did all those segments perform equally well in 2024? Or did that diversification really get tested?
It definitely got tested, and 2024 provided a perfect illustration of why that diversification is so valuable. Performance varied quite a bit across the segments. You had some areas of real strength. Petroleum and chemicals, for instance, saw revenue grow by a healthy 7% year-over-year. Grain and fertilizers were also strong, up 5%.
Okay, so growth in some key areas.
Yes. But that strength was needed to help offset considerable weakness in other, more cyclically sensitive segments. Coal revenue, for example, saw the sharpest decline. It fell 9% year-over-year, reflecting that secular decline we talked about. Automotive revenue was down 5%. And even intermodal, which is usually a reliable growth engine, actually contracted slightly, down 2%.
So a real mixed bag then. The diversification definitely cushioned the overall blow.
It absolutely did. Without strength in those other segments, the overall revenue picture would have looked considerably worse.
That makes sense.
No.
But does this wide exposure also mean C&I's total revenue is very sensitive to broader economic trends? It sounds like it reflects the whole economy.
It absolutely does. While the diverse business mix provides that natural hedge against sector-specific downturns, it also means the company's overall fortunes are very closely tied to the general health of the North American economy. C&I's top-line performance is really a complex function of things like North American industrial production levels, consumer spending habits, global energy prices, and even agricultural cycles like the size and quality of grain crops in Canada and the U.S.
So many external factors influencing their business.
Exactly. And this makes forecasting their revenue inherently challenging. It depends on so many variables that are often outside their direct control. Ultimately, the economic environment you're experiencing, your own consumer choices, even global weather patterns affecting crops, they all have a direct, tangible impact on C&I's diverse business lines.
Okay, let's talk profitability then, because while diversified revenue is good, I understand their margins actually came under some pressure in 2024. What happened there?
You're right. C&I's profitability definitely felt the strain in 2024, and it really highlights the inherent impact of operational challenges on a high fixed cost business like a railroad. Their adjusted operating ratio, again, that key efficiency metric where lower is better, it rose to 62.9% in 2024.
Up from what the year before?
It was up from 60.8% in 2023, so that's a 210 basis point deterioration, or 2.1 percentage points.
That's a noticeable dip in efficiency.
Yeah.
What were the main reasons C&I gave for that margin contraction?
Management pointed primarily to several specific one-off challenges during the year. These included that prolonged labor uncertainty in Canada, which, as we'll discuss more, became a really significant recurring theme for them. There were also disruptive port stoppages on Canada's west coast, which severely impacted imports and exports, and they faced periods of severe winter weather that hampered operations across large parts of their network.
So a combination of labor, port issues, and weather hitting them.
Right. And the direct consequence of all these disruptions, according to management, was that the company ended up being resourced for more volumes than we handled.
Meaning they had the trains, the crews, the capacity ready to go, but the freight didn't materialize as expected.
Exactly. They had the cost structure in place to handle a certain level of business, but because of these external disruptions, the actual revenue-generating volume was lower than planned. So that lower-than-expected revenue had to be spread across a relatively fixed, high-cost base.
Okay, this sounds like that concept of operating leverage we hear about, but working in reverse. Could you explain that for our listeners? What really happens when volumes fall short in an asset-heavy business like this?
That's exactly what it is, negative operating leverage in action. It's a fundamental characteristic of the railroad industry. Railroads have these massive fixed costs, owning and maintaining thousands of miles of track, bridges, signals, plus the locomotives, the rail cars. It's hugely capital intensive, and those costs don't go away easily if volume dips.
Right, you still have to maintain the track even if fewer trains run on it.
Yeah. Precisely. Now, when things are good and volumes are growing, this structure creates powerful, positive operating leverage. Once those fixed costs are covered, each additional carload of freight drops a large portion of its revenue straight to the bottom line. Margins expand rapidly.
Okay, that's the upside.
But the reverse is just as profoundly true, and that's what C&I experienced in 2024. When volumes fall short of projections, those unavoidable fixed costs weigh disproportionately on profitability. Margins contract significantly. It's like running a huge factory at only 70% capacity, but still having to pay 100% of the rent, the utilities, the basic staffing.
A recipe for lower profits.
Definitely. And this dynamic really underscores how sensitive C&I's profitability is to volume fluctuations. It highlights the absolute critical importance for them to maintain network fluidity, keep trains moving efficiently, and achieve high asset utilization to protect their margins. It also raises that important question you alluded to earlier. how effectively can a company like CNI manage these huge fixed costs when unpredictable external factors like those Canadian labor disputes or severe weather keep disrupting their volumes? It's a fundamental challenge for the whole industry, but CNI's recent experience makes it particularly relevant for them.
So those operational pressures that squeeze profitability, I assume they also flowed through and impacted their cash flow generation. Free cash flow is pretty vital for a business that has to invest so much capital.
They certainly did. The linkage is very direct. Those operational and profitability pressures hit CNI's cash generation quite hard in 2024. Their reported free cash flow declined significantly. It came in at $3.09 billion for the year.
Down for what level?
Down noticeably from $3.89 billion in the prior year, 2023. That drop was a direct result of the lower net income, combined with some changes in working capital needs.
Okay, less cash being generated. What about their debt levels? Did that reduction in cash flow lead them to take on more debt, or did their balance sheet leverage increase for other reasons?
Concurrently with the lower cash flow, the company's leverage did tick up. Their key metric here, adjusted debt to adjusted EBITDA, rose to 2.60 times at the end of 2024.
And where was that previously?
It was up from 2.25 times at the end of 2023, so a measurable increase. And that 2.60x is actually slightly above the company's own internal target, which is around 2.5x.
So a bit higher than they'd like. What drove that increase? Was it more debt or lower earnings?
It was primarily driven by the lower EBITDA, the earnings side of the ratio reflecting those profitability pressures we just discussed. Their actual debt level remained relatively stable, around $21.13 billion at year end. So it wasn't that they borrowed a lot more money, it was that the earnings available to cover the existing debt dipped.
Okay. But despite that uptick in leverage and the drop in free cash flow, is their balance sheet still considered fundamentally strong? Or are there growing concerns there?
No. Overall, it's still considered solid. Despite that increase in the leverage ratio, CNI's balance sheet remains robust. They maintain investment-grade credit ratings from all the major rating agencies.
That's important.
Very important. You have to remember, these are incredibly capital-intensive businesses. A certain level of debt is normal and expected. What the 2024 trends really reflect is a period of significant operational stress, combined with CNI's continued unwavering commitment to high levels of capital investment and shareholder returns. Even with the lower cash flow, they still spent $3.55 billion on capital expenditures in 2024, and they returned $2.65 billion to shareholders through share buybacks in addition to their substantial dividend payments.
So they kept investing and returning cash even when times were tougher.
They did. So the takeaway is, while CNI's overall financial position remains strong, it's clearly not immune to the financial consequences of operational disruptions and macroeconomic headwinds. Those things can, and did, temporarily reduce its financial flexibility and cash generation.
Okay, let's dig a bit deeper into that capital allocation piece. Maintaining a network this vast, spanning three coasts, it must require just an enormous amount of ongoing capital expenditure, that CapEx you mentioned. How do they approach that? How do they balance that essential reinvestment in the network with returning money to shareholders?
Yeah, that balancing act is absolutely crucial to their strategy. And frankly, it's a key differentiator for any successful railroad over the long term. As an operator of such a vast capital-hungry network, having a disciplined approach to CapEx is fundamental. It has to be. CNI's strategy really reflects the mature nature of their business. They have to balance the significant, largely non-discretionary spending needed just to maintain the existing network, keep it safe and reliable, with more targeted investments designed to foster future growth and enhance efficiency.
Can you give us a sense of the scale of that annual investment? What are they actually spending that $3.5 billion or so on each year?
Certainly. In 2024, as I mentioned, their gross property additions, that's the CapEx number, totaled $3.55 billion. And the company guided for a similarly substantial investment of about $3.4 billion for 2025.
Okay.
Now, a very large portion of that annual budget, typically well over half, is dedicated to what you could call core maintenance activities. Basic upkeep, but on a massive scale. This is about ensuring the safety, integrity, and reliability of the existing network. It's not just patching potholes. It includes a systematic replacement of steel rail, wooden ties, ballast rock, the stuff that faces immense wear and tear under heavy trains. It also includes ongoing bridge improvements, upgrades to signaling systems across their entire 20,000-mile network in both Canada and the U.S.
So a huge chunk is just keeping the existing railroad running smoothly and safely. It's like constantly rebuilding parts of a massive highway system, invisibly, every single year.
That's a great analogy. A lot of it is just keeping the lights on, keeping the infrastructure sound. But they also allocate a significant portion of that budget, the remainder specifically to growth and productivity initiatives.
Okay, so where are those more strategic dollars going? What kind of projects are we talking about?
These investments are typically very strategically focused on areas expected to generate high returns, strengthen CNI's competitive moat, and align with future market trends. Recent examples would include projects aimed at building more capacity in their intermodal business. We know that's a growth area. So maybe acquiring new containers, making critical improvements to intermodal terminals in busy hubs like the Chicago area, which is a major bottleneck for the entire North American rail system.
Try to speed things up there.
Exactly. Reduce dwell times, improve fluidity. They're also actively developing new logistics hubs and transload facilities. For instance, they highlighted investments in Michigan recently. These facilities help them better serve specific customers or industries, expand their reach, and make it easier for goods to transfer between rail and truck. So it's this dual focus. Maintain the core asset relentlessly, while also selectively investing in projects that position them for future growth and efficiency gains. That's essential for long-term value creation in this industry.
Got it. Now, switching to the other side of capital allocation, returning cash to shareholders, how does CNI approach that? Is it mainly through dividends, or do share repurchases play a big role too?
CNI has a very long and remarkably consistent track record of returning significant capital to its shareholders. They employ a balanced policy, combining a steadily growing dividend with a more flexible share repurchase program. The dividend really is the cornerstone of their return strategy. CNI boasts an incredibly impressive history, 28 consecutive years of dividend growth.
28 years straight. Yeah. That's quite a streak.
It really is, especially for a cyclical business. It's a powerful testament to management's confidence in the long-term stability and the robust cash-generating power of the business, even through economic ups and downs. In 2024, they paid out $3.38 per share. And importantly, their dividend payout ratio, the percentage of earnings paid out as dividends, was around 48%. That's quite sustainable, indicating the dividend is well covered by earnings with ample capacity for future increases.
Okay, so the dividend is reliable, growing, and sustainable. What about the share buybacks? How do they fit into the picture, especially given that free cash flow can fluctuate like it did in 2024?
Right. Share repurchases serve as the primary vehicle for returning excess cash flow to shareholders above and beyond the dividend commitment. The key word there is flexible. The scale of CNI's buyback program is generally opportunistic and directly linked to the company's annual financial performance and cash generation. So, for instance, back in 2023, which was a stronger year financially, CNI repurchased a hefty $4.55 billion of its own shares.
Okay, that's significant.
Very significant. But then in 2024, as free cash flow declined due to those operational challenges we discussed, the company prudently dialed back its buybacks. They repurchased $2.65 billion worth of shares that year.
So they adjusted based on the cash coming in.
Exactly. This flexible approach allows CNI to return substantial capital to shareholders during strong years, helping to boost earnings per share. But it also lets them preserve balance sheet strength and maintain financial flexibility during periods of weaker performance or higher uncertainty.
So what does this all mean? They're clearly focused on maintaining their core assets, strategically investing to the future where it makes sense, while still consistently rewarding their shareholders, adapting the buyback lever based on the circumstances.
That sums it up nicely. It's a disciplined, balanced approach aimed at long-term, sustainable value creation.
That provides a clear picture of their financial discipline and priorities. Looking forward now, let's explore where CNI sees its biggest opportunities for future growth. Intermodal transportation seems to stand out as a really key area, especially with the tailwinds from e-commerce and this trend of nearshoring.
Absolutely. Intermodal is, without doubt, one of CNI's most significant long-term growth opportunities. It's strategically vital for them. Remember, this segment involves moving goods in those standardized containers that can easily transfer between ships, trains, and trucks. It already accounted for a hefty 22% of CNI's total revenue in 2024. And crucially, CNI holds a commanding market share, about 46% of all Canadian intermodal traffic. So they are the dominant player in that critical cross-border market.
46% is huge. And I imagine this growth is tightly linked to the absolute explosion we've seen in e-commerce over the last decade or more.
Precisely. The secular shift towards online shopping has fundamentally altered consumer expectations and reshaped logistics networks globally. And while trucks are obviously essential for that final mile delivery to your home or business, Rail is by far the most efficient and cost-effective mode for the long-haul portion of the journey. Moving those containers, often thousands of miles, from coastal ports where they arrive from overseas to inland distribution hubs closer to consumers.
And CNI's network is particularly well-suited for this.
It really is. CNI is strategically positioned to be a primary beneficiary of this trend, that unique tri-coastal network we keep mentioning, particularly those direct routes from Pacific ports like Prince Rupert and Vancouver, straight into the U.S., Midwest, and Eastern Canada. It offers arguably the most efficient pathway for containerized goods arriving from Asia to reach the heart of the North American consumer market.
So every time you click Buy Now online for something made overseas, there's a good chance CNI is involved in getting it closer to you.
A very good chance, yes. Its journey often involves a long ride on a CNI train.
So are they actively investing to capitalize on this, trying to make their intermodal service even better, maybe more competitive with trucks?
They are. Recognizing this massive opportunity, CNI is making targeted, substantial investments specifically aimed at enhancing its intermodal service offering. They're actively working to improve both the speed and, critically, the reliability of their intermodal service. The goal is to close the gap with the transit times offered by over-the-road trucking, especially on key lanes.
Making it more truck-like, as you said earlier.
Exactly. That's the phrase they often use. Initiatives include things like acquiring new, more efficient intermodal containers, expanding capacity at key terminals to reduce congestion, remember Chicago, and investing in those inland logistics hubs we mentioned, like in Michigan, to improve network fluidity and cut down dwell times. It's all about making their intermodal product faster, more reliable, more predictable, allowing it to capture an even larger share of the growing e-commerce logistics market from long-haul trucks.
Okay, and what about that nearshoring trend we keep hearing about? The idea that manufacturing might be shifting from Asia to places closer, like Mexico. Does that play into CNI's intermodal growth strategy too?
It absolutely does. The trend of nearshoring, or sometimes friendshoring, where companies move manufacturing production out of, say, China and into countries like Mexico, that presents another really significant potential tailwind for CNI's intermodal franchise.
How so?
Well, as more goods are manufactured in Mexico, specifically for consumption in the U.S. and Canada, you see a natural increase in north-south trade flows. And CNI's network, extending deep into the U.S. Midwest and connecting seamlessly into Canada, is incredibly well-positioned to handle large volumes of those finished goods and components moving north from Mexico via intermodal trains.
So even though CPKC might have a more direct Mexico route, CNI still benefits significantly.
Yes, because the volumes are expected to grow substantially for everyone. CNI's network provides access to vast consumer markets and manufacturing centers that the CPKC network might not reach as directly. It's not just a theoretical trend, it's a tangible shift in global supply chains that will likely drive significant intermodal volume growth for CNI, directly impacting how and where the goods you buy are made and transported across the continent. Now, moving beyond intermodal, the global energy transition. This presents a really interesting mix for CNI, both significant risks, but also potentially significant new opportunities. Remember, CNI transports a really diverse portfolio of energy-related commodities, so the shifting composition of the world's energy mix is going to directly impact its future traffic volumes, for better or worse.
Okay, so starting with the risks, the most obvious one has to be coal, right?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a business clearly in long-term decline.
That's the primary and most evident risk, yes. The secular decline of thermal coal, the kind used for power generation, is real. It's accelerating in many places as utilities switch to natural gas and renewables. It's a structural headwind for CNI, and we saw that clearly in their 2024 results, where coal revenue fell by 9%. That acted as a significant drag on their overall top-line growth. CNI can't stop that global trend. They can only adapt their business around it.
Okay, so coal is declining. But are there new opportunities emerging from this same energy transition? Where is CNI finding growth or potential growth in this changing energy landscape?
Absolutely. The transition isn't just about decline. It also creates compelling new avenues for growth for a railroad like CNI. Their network originates in the energy-rich regions of Western Canada, which produce not just coal, but also vast amounts of crude oil, natural gas liquids, NGLs, and refined fuels. Many of these products will remain critical components of the energy mix for decades to come, even during the transition.
So moving oil and gas products is still a growth area?
Potentially, yes, especially certain segments. Remember, CNI's petroleum and chemicals segment was actually one of their strongest performers in 2024, with revenue growth of 7%. Management has specifically highlighted things like NGLs used in plastics and heating and refined fuels like diesel and gasoline as growing segments where their network provides a distinct competitive advantage for reaching markets across the continent.
Interesting. What about the actual infrastructure needed for renewable energy, like wind turbines or solar panels? Does CNI play a role in transporting those massive components?
Yeah. Yes, and it's a crucial role. The sheer scale of the build-out required for renewable energy infrastructure creates significant new freight demand, specifically for heavy haul rail. Think about the components involved in a large wind turbine. The tower sections can weigh many tons. The nacelles housing the generators are huge, and the blades themselves can stretch over 200 feet long.
Stuff that definitely can't go easily by truck.
Exactly. These large, often oversized components are ideally suited for rail transport. CNI's extensive network is critical for moving these components, often from manufacturing sites or ports where they're imported, to remote project locations across the continent where wind or solar farms are being built. CNI is actively positioning itself to be a key logistics partner for this green energy build-out. They see direct revenue growth opportunities from moving the materials needed for these vital infrastructure projects.
So they're helping build the infrastructure for the energy transition.
In a very real way, yes. And beyond that, the company is also positioned to potentially transport emerging energy sources like biofuels or renewable diesel, which are often produced in the agricultural regions of the prairies and the Midwest that are well served by CNI's network. What's truly insightful here, I think, is how CNI must adapt its core business, hauling heavy stuff long distances, to these massive global trends like the energy transition. They have to find growth in new areas like renewables components or NGLs, where others might only see the inevitable decline of legacy businesses like thermal coal. This really raises an important question, though. How effectively can they actually execute this pivot? Can they capture sufficient volume in these growing segments quickly enough to offset the guaranteed secular decline in coal? That's a key strategic challenge for them.
Okay, now let's shift focus again and talk about some of the significant headwinds CNI has faced recently, particularly those labor disputes and the broader macroeconomic pressures. I understand CNI has a particular vulnerability when it comes to Canadian labor relations that maybe sets it apart from its U.S. peers. Can you elaborate on that?
That's a really critical point, and you're right. It's perhaps CNI's most acute and differentiating risk factor compared to the big U.S. railroads. CNI's operational stability, and therefore its financial performance, is highly exposed to the Canadian labor environment. And this exposure has proven to be a significant, recurring, and often less controllable risk factor. We saw a stark illustration of this vulnerability just last year in 2024.
Right. What exactly happened in 2024 that highlights this particular issue for CNI?
Well, in August 2024, there was a brief but highly disruptive labor dispute. It involved workers at both CNI and its rival, CPKC. It led to a lockout and then a strike that effectively shut down almost all freight rail operations right across Canada for several days.
A complete shutdown.
Pretty much. And the impact was immediate and severe. It hit the national supply chain hard, halting the flow of goods to and from ports, disrupting manufacturing, impacting agriculture, everything. CNI management later estimated that each single day of that work stoppage required something like 3 to 5 days of careful network recovery time afterwards.
Wow. It takes that long to get things moving again.
Yeah, it highlights the immense difficulty of restarting a complex, finely tuned, scheduled system like a major railroad once it's been completely shut down. You can't just flip a switch. You have to reposition crews, trains, clear backlogs. It's a massive undertaking.
And that wasn't the only labor issue impacting them last year, was it? It feels like Canadian ports were constantly in the news with labor problems.
No, it wasn't just the railways. That rail dispute was actually compounded by separate labor stoppages that hit key Canadian ports later in the fall of 2024. We saw disruptions at the Port of Vancouver, the Port of Prince Rupert, both critical for CNI's Pacific Gateway traffic, and also the Port of Montreal on the Atlantic side.
So problems at both ends of their network.
Exactly. And this had a material negative impact on CNI's volumes and their financial results, especially hitting that important intermodal segment because the flow of containers through the ports was severely curtailed for periods. CNI's CEO even commented publicly that the prolonged uncertainty around both port and rail labor led some international shippers to actually divert U.S.-bound cargo away from Canadian ports altogether.
Sending it through U.S. ports instead.
Yes, routing it onto U.S. railroads just to avoid the risk of further disruption in Canada. That's a direct loss of business for CNI, driven entirely by these external labor factors.
That really underscores how disruptive and damaging these Canadian labor issues can be for CNI specifically. What about the broader macroeconomic environment? How has persistent inflation and slowing economic growth affected their business?
Well, as a carrier of the fundamental goods that power the economy, raw materials, industrial components, finished products, CNI's performance is inextricably linked to the overall health of the North American industrial sector and broader consumer demand. And the period from, say, 2023 through mid-2025, it's been characterized by significant macroeconomic uncertainty. We've seen persistent inflation, sharply higher interest rates, and generally slowing economic growth across North America. All of that has created pretty significant headwinds for CNI's freight volumes across almost all of their commodity segments.
So if manufacturing activity slows down, CNI feels that pinch directly in lower volumes.
Precisely. The North American manufacturing sector, for example, has shown persistent weakness recently. Key indicators like the ISM manufacturing PMI have remained in contraction territory below 50 for much of the period. And that sluggishness translates directly into lower demand for the raw materials CNI hauls into factories and the intermediate and finished goods they haul out of factories. CNI's 2024 results clearly reflected this broader weakness. Management explicitly cited a weaker-than-expected macro environment as a key factor behind the volume declines they saw in segments like forest products, automotive, and even intermodal.
So for you, the listener, these big external factors from Canadian labor relations to shifts in the global economy, they directly impact the flow of goods, the efficiency of the supply chain, and ultimately they can affect the reliability and the cost of the products you consume every day. It's that silent ripple effect of macro events.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Okay, let's turn now to how the market views CNI. Specifically, let's talk about its valuation and the broader oversight of the company. When we look at CNI's valuation multiples, things like PE ratios, how does it stack up against its direct competitors and maybe against its own historical levels?
Right. Looking at valuation, an analysis of Canadian National's current multiples suggests that the stock is trading at a level that's, well, roughly in line with its direct class I peers. And interestingly, it appears to be trading at a slight discount compared to its own historical averages over, say, the last 5 years.
Okay, so maybe a bit cheaper than it has been historically.
Potentially, yes. As of mid-2025, CNI's stock was trading at a trailing price-to-earnings, or PE, ratio somewhere in the range of 18.2x to 20.x, depending on the exact calculation. That's actually below its five-year average PE ratio, which has been closer to 21.7x. So on that basis, it looks less expensive relative to its recent past.
And how does that compare to the other big six railroads? Is CNI seen as a premium company, a discount, or just middle of the pack?
Compared to its Class I peers, CNI's valuation seems pretty comparable right now. It's not a significant outlier. That PE ratio in the 18 by 21X range is similar to Union Pacific, which was around 20.6X, similar to CSX at about 20.5X, and maybe slightly higher than Norfolk Southern, which was closer to 19.1X. If you look at another common metric, enterprise value to EBITDA, which is often preferred for asset-heavy companies because it includes debt CNI trades in a range of about 11.4x to 13.1x. Again, broadly in line with peers. This tells us the market generally sees CNI as a solid, high-quality railroad, but perhaps not commanding a distinct valuation premium right now compared to the other major players. It's being valued as part of that stable, mature industry group.
So it sounds like the market is doing a careful balancing act with CNI's stock price. What factors do you think it's weighing most heavily right now?
I think this valuation suggests the market is currently balancing CNI's undeniable high-quality strategic network assets, that unique tri-coastal reach we've emphasized, against several significant offsetting factors or concerns. The stock doesn't seem to be getting a major valuation premium specifically for that unique network right now.
Why might that be?
It likely reflects investor concerns about a few key things we've discussed. One, the recent deterioration in its operating ratio, that dip in efficiency relative to peers. Two, the emergence of a stronger direct competitive threat from the newly formed CPKC, especially on those north-south routes. And three, arguably, a perceived higher risk profile associated with its significant exposure to the Canadian labor and political environment, given the disruptions we saw in 2024.
So the market might be putting a bit of a discount on CNI due to those Canadian-specific risks?
It's certainly possible that's playing a role in preventing the stock from trading at a premium to its peers, despite the network advantage. Now, a bullish investor, looking at the same facts, might argue the opposite. They might say the market is being too short-sighted, overly focused on these near-term headwinds, and that it's actually underappreciating the long-term durable value of CNI's foundational franchise and its unique network position. That's the bull versus bear debate right now.
Okay, that makes sense. And speaking of long-term value, CNI does have that strong reputation for shareholder returns. Can you elaborate on that aspect? Does that provide some support for the valuation?
Yes, I think CNI's capital return policy definitely provides a compelling and reliable source of total return for shareholders, which likely offers a degree of valuation support for the stock, especially for income-focused investors. As of mid-2025, CNI's forward dividend yield was running in the range of 2.4% to 2.76%.
How does that yield compare to its peers? Is it attractive?
It is quite attractive, yes, particularly within the Class I Railroad Group. That yield is significantly higher than its main Canadian rival, CPKC, which was yielding only about 0.90%. It also exceeds the yield of CSX, which was around 1.46%, and it's roughly on par with the yield offered by Union Pacific at about 2.49%. So it stands out positively on yield.
And that incredible dividend growth history must play a big role in investor confidence, too. 28 consecutive years of increases is remarkable.
Absolutely. CNI's long and incredibly consistent history of dividend growth, those 28 straight years, really enhances its appeal, particularly for dividend growth investors and those seeking reliable income streams. That unwavering commitment to increasing the dividend, even through various economic cycles and operational challenges, serves as a powerful testament to the underlying stability and the robust, predictable, cash-generating power of the business over the long term. When you combine that solid, reliably growing dividend with the substantial and generally consistent share repurchase program we discussed earlier, it makes for a strong total shareholder yield. This reliable return of capital is definitely a key attraction of the stock. It provides investors with a tangible cash return, and it also signals management's confidence in the company's long-term cash-generating capabilities.
Okay, beyond the financials and valuation, what about the inherent risks of just operating such a massive physical network? Especially considering its role as critical national infrastructure. What keeps CNI's managers awake at night?
Right. As a physical network operator on such a vast scale, CNI is inherently exposed to a wide range of operational risks. It's just the nature of the business. These include the ever-present potential for derailments, collisions, and other accidents. These can, unfortunately, result in injuries or fatalities, cause significant service disruptions, lead to huge environmental cleanup costs and financial liabilities, and cause serious reputational damage.
And weather must be a huge factor, too, given their network spans Canada and the U.S.
Oh, absolutely. The company's operations are highly vulnerable to severe weather events. Think extreme cold-snapping rails in winter, heavy snow-blocking lines, spring flooding washing out track beds, even wildfires in Western Canada and the U.S. potentially damaging bridges or forcing reroutes. Any of these can cause widespread network outages and significantly increase operating costs for detours or repairs. Furthermore, even without major incidents, simple network congestion, particularly at key hubs like Chicago or major interchange points with other railroads, can degrade service quality, slow down shipments, and reduce overall efficiency, leading to frustrated customers.
And CNI's status as critical national infrastructure, does that amplify these risks? Does it mean failures have bigger consequences?
It absolutely does. That designation, which applies in both Canada and the U.S., elevates these operational risks significantly beyond typical corporate concerns. A prolonged major outage on CNI's network wouldn't just hurt the company's bottom line. It could have severe cascading consequences for the entire North American economy. It could disrupt critical supply chains for essential goods like food, energy, chemicals, manufactured components. Everything.
So a big failure would attract a lot of attention.
Immense attention. This systemic importance invites intense regulatory scrutiny, political pressure, and public anger if things go wrong. It increases the pressure on CNI to maintain the absolute high standards of safety, security, and service reliability at all times. It's a constant high-stakes balancing act between running efficiently and ensuring resilience.
And what about those broader economic cycles? How quickly does a slowdown in the North American economy typically translate into pain for CNI?
Beyond the operational risks, CNI's business remains highly cyclical. It's directly correlated with the health of the overall North American economy. There's really no escaping that. A recession or even just a significant economic slowdown would inevitably lead to lower freight volumes across nearly all of its commodity segments. Fewer cars being built means less auto traffic. Less construction means less lumber. Less consumer spending means fewer intermodal containers. That translates directly into reduced revenues and lower profitability due to that operating leverage we discussed. They are fundamentally a gauge and a participant of economic activity.
We talked about the regulatory environment earlier, the STB and CTA. Are there specific regulatory risks on the horizon that could impose significant new costs or constrain CNI's operational flexibility in the future?
Yes, that's always a possibility. CNI operates in this highly regulated industry, subject to oversight from multiple government bodies on both sides of the border. Potential changes to economic regulations, maybe the STB becoming more aggressive on rate reviews or shipper complaints, could impact their pricing power. Or perhaps more likely, new safety or environmental mandates coming from the FRA in the U.S. or Transport Canada could impose significant additional costs.
Like what kind of mandates?
For instance, stricter rules around train crew sizes, new requirements for installing advanced braking systems, or maybe more stringent emission standards for locomotives. Any of these could require massive new capital outlays or changes to operating practices that could impact efficiency and profitability. Regulatory risk is a constant backdrop for this industry.
Okay, let's unpack this. While CNI is clearly a well-managed company with a strong strategic foundation, it's definitely not immune to a unique and challenging set of risks, particularly when it comes to the unpredictable nature of operational events, those macroeconomic cycles, and maybe most distinctively, those labor relations issues in Canada. Let's revisit that Canadian labor risk one more time, because you called it the most acute and differentiating one for CNI. Just how significant is it compared to their U.S. peers?
I really think it is the most acute and differentiating risk factor, yes. As 2024 demonstrated so clearly, labor relations are a major recurring source of risk that can, quite literally, paralyze the company and disrupt the entire Canadian economy. The structure of labor laws in Canada is different from the U.S., and critically, the high concentration of national rail traffic on just two dominant carriers, CNI and CPKC, means that a labor dispute at either one or both simultaneously can escalate incredibly quickly and have a profoundly paralyzing effect. There just aren't easy alternatives for shippers.
So a strike hits harder and faster in Canada?
Arguably, yes, because the network is so concentrated. The mere threat of strikes or lockouts creates significant uncertainty for shippers, forcing them to make contingency plans, which cost them money and might cause them to divert traffic, as we saw happen. These actual or potential disruptions represent CNI's most significant and probably least controllable risk factor when you compare them directly to their large U.S.-based peers like Union Pacific or BNSF, which operate under a different labor framework and within a more fragmented market in some ways. It's a continuous, often simmering challenge that CNI management constantly has to navigate.
Okay, that's a clear picture of the risks. Finally, let's touch on the people steering this incredibly complex ship management and corporate governance. Who is leading CNI today, and how are they ensuring the company is being managed effectively for long-term resilience and shareholder value?
Right. Canadian National is currently led by a pretty experienced executive team with deep roots in the railroad industry itself, which is important. Their CEO is Tracy Robinson. She was appointed back in February 2022. And she brought really extensive and highly relevant experience to the role, having spent, I believe, 27 years previously at CNI's main rival, Canadian Pacific Railway.
Wow, 27 years of the competition. That's some serious insider knowledge.
It's invaluable experience, yes. Knows the industry inside and out. Their CFO, Ghislaine Houle, also possesses decades of relevant financial and operational experience within CNI itself. So you have a leadership team with a deep understanding of the complexities of running a Class I railroad. This isn't a company bringing in outside leaders unfamiliar with the sector. It's seasoned rail veterans at the helm.
And what about the board overseeing them? Does CNI's corporate governance structure align with what we consider best practices today, especially given the company's critical role in the economy?
Generally, yes. It appears very robust and well-aligned with current best practices for corporate governance. The board of directors is composed of a substantial majority of independent directors, meaning they don't have ties to management or the company outside their board role. That independence is a key check on management power. Furthermore, CNI separates the critical roles of board chair and chief executive officer. The chair leads the board. The CEO runs the company.
That separation is considered important, right?
It is, yes. It's widely seen as a key tenet of strong corporate governance, as it helps ensure independent oversight of management by the board and maintains a clear division of responsibilities. Also, the board's key committees like audit, finance and risk, human resources and compensation, and governance and sustainability are composed entirely of independent directors. This structure signals a strong commitment to transparency, accountability, and objective decision-making at the board level.
That sounds like a solid governance framework. How does this translate into practice in terms of managing those significant risks we discussed and engaging with shareholders?
The company materials, like their annual proxy statement, indicate that the board and management demonstrate a strong focus on enterprise risk management, identifying and mitigating those key risks, and also on robust shareholder engagement. CNI emphasizes the board's active role in overseeing strategic and business risks, its commitment to maintaining an open and consistent dialogue with shareholders to understand their perspectives, and its unwavering focus on creating long-term sustainable value, not just short-term results.
Which is crucial for a company with such long-lived assets.
Absolutely. For a company of CNI's scale, complexity, and systemic importance, this commitment to strong governance isn't just procedural box-ticking, it's actually a critical risk mitigant in itself. It provides confidence to investors and stakeholders that the company is being managed thoughtfully for long-term resilience and with shareholder interests clearly in mind. They seem to have clear processes for identifying, assessing, and attempting to mitigate those complex operational, financial, and strategic risks we spent time discussing.
And one last piece on governance executive compensation. How is it structured at CNI? Is it designed to truly align the interests of the top executives with the long-term interests of shareholders?
CNI's executive compensation program appears to be heavily weighted towards at-risk, performance-based pay, which is generally designed to create that strong alignment between management incentives and shareholder outcomes. For the company's top executives, the named executive officers listed in the proxy, approximately 82.4%. So the vast majority of their target total direct compensation is variable, meaning it depends on hitting specific performance targets. It's not guaranteed salary.
Okay, so mostly performance-based. What kind of performance?
Their short-term incentive, which is the annual incentive bonus plan, is determined by a balanced scorecard approach. It's weighted 70% towards achieving specific corporate financial objectives, like revenue growth and operating ratio targets. But importantly, it also includes non-financial goals. 20% is weighted towards strategic objectives, which currently include things like greenhouse gas emission reduction targets and improving customer centricity metrics. And the remaining 10% is tied directly to safety performance, measured by things like accident and injury rates.
So it's not just about hitting the financial numbers. Strategy and especially safety are explicitly part of the bonus calculation, which seems critical for a railroad.
Exactly. This structure is designed to incentivize management to pursue not just strong financial results in the short term, but also to advance the company's longer-term strategic goals and, crucially, to maintain a relentless focus on safety, recognizing that safety really underpins everything else in this industry. Then, their long-term incentives are delivered primarily through a mix of performance share units, PSUs, and stock options. This directly links a significant portion of executive wealth creation to the company's long-term stock performance and underlying business results. The vesting of those PSUs, for example, is contingent on achieving specific multi-year targets for metrics like return on invested capital, ROIC, a key measure of profitability and capital discipline, and also relative total shareholder return, TSR, compared to a transportation industry index.
So they have to outperform their peers to get the full long-term payout.
That's the idea. The use of metrics like ROIC and relative TSR encourages management to make disciplined capital allocation decisions and strive for outperformance versus their competitors over the long haul. So, circling back, in a capital-intensive industry like railroading, with such high fixed costs, significant operational risks, and those external vulnerabilities we've discussed, having strong, experienced leadership combined with transparent, robust governance and well-aligned executive compensation is absolutely critical. It provides a crucial layer of confidence that the company is being managed effectively for long-term resilience and in the best interests of its shareholders.
Okay, we have covered a tremendous amount of ground today exploring Canadian National Railway Company. Just to quickly recap the key points, CNI stands as a true cornerstone of North American logistics, primarily leveraging that unique and powerful tri-coastal network, which remains its most significant, durable competitive advantage.
That's right. But we also saw that CNI's competitive edge, which was once largely driven by its pioneering role in operational efficiency through PSR, now relies much more heavily on achieving superior, consistent execution. Because PSR itself has become the industry standard. Everyone's running a similar playbook now.
And they operate in this mature, oligopolistic industry characterized by incredibly high barriers to entry, which provides inherent stability. But crucially, they are facing new direct competition, particularly from the merged CPKC, especially in those increasingly important north-south trade lanes between Mexico, the U.S., and Canada.
And despite having well-diversified revenue streams across many different commodity groups, which is a definite strength, C&I's profitability and its cash flow remain quite sensitive to those broader macroeconomic pressures, and perhaps most uniquely for them, also highly sensitive to the significant risks posed by Canadian labor disputes and port stoppages, as we saw play out quite dramatically in 2024.
But through those challenges, the company appears to maintain a disciplined capital allocation strategy. They're carefully balancing that essential reinvestment needed to maintain and strategically enhance their vast network with providing a consistent and growing return of capital to shareholders, primarily through that reliable dividend and a flexible share repurchase program.
And looking ahead, C&I's future growth prospects seem heavily tied to its ability to successfully capitalize on the continued expansion of intermodal traffic fueled by those long-term trends of e-commerce and nearshoring, and also its ability to adeptly navigate the complex risks and opportunities presented by the global energy transition, pivoting away from declining commodities like coal towards newer opportunities. It's really a story of adaptation for this foundational giant in a quietly vital industry.
So here's a final thought for you, our listener, to mull over. As global supply chains continue to shift and evolve, with e-commerce still booming and manufacturing potentially moving closer to home in North America, how will C&I's unique strategic network and, maybe more importantly, its demonstrated ability or challenge to adapt and execute flawlessly? How will that define its role in the coming years? Will it be just a transport company? Or will it solidify its position as a truly critical enabler of North America's future economic resilience, ensuring that continuous vital flow of goods that touches your daily life in countless ways?
It's really a question of how well this established foundational giant can continue to pivot, perfect its operations, and navigate the inevitable disruptions in an ever-changing global and continental landscape.
We encourage you to consider the unseen but absolutely vital role these huge rail networks, like C&I's, play in your own economic landscape every day. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.